Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. I'm Eric Olson. It's America's Most Haunted Radio once again, and we have a fantastic show this evening. We're talking about the Afterlife Conference with conference founder Terry Daniel. The fourth annual Afterlife Conference is coming to Portland, the one in Oregon. June 5th through 8th, the basic philosophy of the conference is that making plans for the end of life and beyond, my friends, emotionally, socially, physically, and spiritually, could be the greatest gift we can give to ourselves and our loved ones. Every summer since 2010, a consortium of leading researchers, educators, and spiritual counselors has gathered together to help guide people toward that gift by unraveling the mysteries of death and the afterlife. Those are large freaking topics, my friends. The conference brings together people from all over the world to hear renowned experts speak about the end of end of life care, near death experience, conscious dying, and conscious grieving. This year's roster, which is mighty, I might add, as an aside, of presenters includes some of the leading names in the field, including Dr. Raymond Moody, author of the breakthrough book Life After Life, and neurosurgeon Eben Alexander, author of the New York Times bestseller, Proof of Heaven. The conference includes all kinds of other stuff that we will be talking about, and we're going to get right into it with Terry. But first, let's talk a little bit about her. Well, actually, you know what? It was too long. I cut it out. I'd have to open my Facebook back up again. So let's do something much better and welcome Terry herself to the show. Terry, who has done four interviews already today and is really warmed up and ready to roll. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. That was the best introduction I've heard all day, and I've heard this is the fourth. That was excellent. Thank you, Eric.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you. What a fascinating, fascinating topic. I mean, as your literature says, you know, what is more important than having a sense of where we're heading, how we're getting there, and what's going to happen after the apparent, anyway, end? Why don't you tell us just a little bit, give us a little bit of background on you, yourself. And then how did that all lead to your founding this conference?
Okay, well, I just want to back up to something you said about, having information about where it is all going. In order to understand where it's all going, we have to sort of understand where it all came from, because where we go when we die is the same place that we were before we came in. So it's a revolving door. So it really helps. You can't really look at the world beyond the death of the body without looking at the world before the birth of the body, because it is circular. So that's a big piece of it, but we can come back to that. I'm going to give you the really short version of my bio. Basically, I was always a metaphysically minded person. I've always been fascinated with spiritual things since I was a kid. My mother and grandmother were both psychic. Fast forward to me being 48 years old, and my 10-year-old son was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. He died when he was 16 and began communicating with me from the other side 30 minutes after he died. I was not surprised when that happened. I kind of expected it because I had been doing a lot of work with channelers and psychics and kind of working through this whole thing of why do I have this child who's going to die? What does this mean for our path together? Instead of the usual, I mean, of course I had, you know, the normal shock and grief and pain, but because of my metaphysical perspective that I'd had all my life, I looked at it as more interesting than tragic. And I think because of that, it allowed my intuitive conduit to be more open so that I could communicate with him after he died. And that was 7 years ago. And through that communication and his sort of guiding me from the other side, my life completely changed. I went back to school. I got a degree in theology. I wrote 3 books, and I started the Afterlife Conference. So that's the short version of the story.
Wow.
Well, that was like speed talking.
That's a lot going on.
Yeah.
In a short period of time. Well, first of all, I'm very, very sorry about your son. It sounds like you have worked your way through it probably kind of every day. You probably continue to do so, and it sounds like you have been comforted, I assume, I don't want to put words in your mouth, by this life or afterlife communication. What has he tried to convey to you? What is the essence of your communication?
Well, he started talking to me 30 minutes after he died, and it was basically like, okay, high five, let's get this party started. Here's what we came here to do. First thing you need to do is start taking notes because I'm going to tell you a lot of stuff. And those notes turned into 3 books. The essence of what he's telling me is, well, let's see, how can I boil that down to a few key points? One, there is no death. We don't really die. The body dies, of course, but there is something, an essence, an energy that continues. And once we understand this, our understanding of everything that happens in life, all the tragedies and losses and sadness, begin to make more sense, because when we stop seeing time as linear, you know, going from point A to point B, we live and then we die. If we stop seeing it that way and see that it is continuous and that we are interconnected with everybody and everything, it's sort of a view from space, our little personal egocentric dramas are not as overwhelming. So the example I often use is if a tragedy happens, like you get sideswiped by a drunk driver and you're left paralyzed, I mean, that's tragic. It's horrible. It's the worst thing that could happen. But it's within your own little personality tied to your physical identity that sees that as a tragedy. If you back out and look at it from the soul level, which is part of this enormous kaleidoscope of interaction that everything in the universe is interconnected on, it doesn't seem like a tragedy. It seems like an event that happens to further the growth of the collective or the turning of the wheel. Does that make sense? I've been talking about this all day, so I'm a little loopy.
Well, I'm always loopy, so we are soulmates. Yes, it makes sense. Is this for you? I mean, aspects of this sound a fair amount like, at least aspects as I understand them, of Buddhism. Are you coming at this from a religious standpoint, from a philosophical standpoint, from a scientific standpoint, or all of the above?
Oh, I would say it could be all of the above. Probably not religious, but certainly spiritual. And it is very much Buddhist. But, you know, I have understood this now as a kaleidoscope. And if you think of a kaleidoscope, all the pieces are separate, but they move together. And so every event that happens in the universe, whether it's an earthquake or a bird landing on a tree, turns the kaleidoscope a little bit, and everything turns and moves together. That's definitely a Buddhist idea. Someday science may even catch up to that idea. And it could be a theological or religious idea as well. But what it says is that nothing moves or operates or experiences independently of anything else. What it's not is a traditional Judeo-Christian idea where everything is separate. So in that sense, it's definitely spiritual. Scientific, I don't know. I mean, we're getting to the place where science is certainly catching up. We have people like, you know, medical doctors like Eben Alexander and Raymond Moody and Gary Schwartz, all these people who are going to be at my conference, doing research into all of this. And so hopefully we're going in that direction where science will actually come up with a proof or an explanation.
Before we get real deeply into the conference itself, and of course I very much want to talk about that, and you have all kinds of great speakers, and you're going off in many different directions all under this afterlife umbrella. But I'm real interested then in also how do you work with the people who you work with? Because part of this process that you described that sort of took place after the passing of your son, you've become lots of things, very impressive things. Anyway, you are an ordained interfaith minister. You're a clinical chaplain. Obviously, you're an author, as we discussed. I want to circle back to that a little bit, too, and talk about the individual books. And an intuitive counselor. So how do you interact with people, and who are you typically working with under those various rubrics?
Those rubrics each have their own different audience. So as an intuitive counselor, I have, you know, clients of my own, and I also do a lot of lectures and workshops and seminars, and I teach people how to sort of shift their perceptions from the traditional view of being not part of, how can I say this, not part of creation, but separate from creation. In other words, let me go back to grief. I work with a lot of people who are dealing with grief. And in using the kaleidoscope example and everything I said before, grief is terrible. Grief hurts. It's unbearable. Losing a child is the worst imaginable thing, as everybody knows. But grief can be perceived differently. Our role on earth can be perceived differently. So this is what I try to teach to my clients and the people in my workshop. For example, I had a woman who came up to me once and said, all four of my children have died in four unrelated events. She said, I thought if I was a good person and pleased God, nothing bad would ever happen to me. And so what I try to teach is if you are looking at your experiences through that lens, through this idea you were given when you were 6 years old in Sunday school, that there's this God who lives in the sky with a clipboard making decisions about what happens to you, and if you're really, really good, nothing bad will happen, and if you're bad, you'll be punished. If you're looking at your life through that lens, you're looking at it through the view of a five-year-old. And what I try to do is help people unravel that view a little bit and realize that it doesn't work that way. Conflict and suffering and pain and loss are necessary for a complete existence, like opposite charges, positive and negative charges on a battery. So that's the big piece that I do with my grief counseling clients, is first of all to accept that, and this is, you know, one of the first noble truth of Buddhism, suffering exists. There's nothing that could ever protect us from suffering and loss in this life. So those beliefs need to just be thrown out the window. That's a good place to start. And that's huge. A lot of people can't do that.
The wheel of samsara.
Pretty much, yep, exactly.
Hey,
the four noble
we have
truths.
A call. Do you mind interrupting for a moment and just
Not
take a call? We'll see what this
I love calls.
Oh, I love calls, too. Although we typically do not solicit them, but we will accept them. Hey, area code 713, you're on with Terry. Hello? Area code 713, do you have a question?
Oh. Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Area code 713, do you have a question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I really didn't have a question, and I didn't realize that I had pressed on number one to chime in. But I'm basically just listening, and I think it's, I mean, I do believe that it's a serious pain and a heartache when a person actually loses the life of their children. And I can see a person really being angry with God, because, of course, we, you know, those that do believe in God, they really expect for him to protect them if you're constantly trusting and having faith in him. So, of course, a person will think, well, maybe, you know, why, or actually just feel, you know, why me? You know, why do I deserve to go through such hurt and pain of losing a child? You know, a child is, I've never lost my kids, any of my kids, so, but I know that it could be really painful. I do know people who have. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't really have any questions. I do believe, though, that, what is your name? You specialize in...
My name is Terry, and I'd actually, can I ask you a question? Because you're a really good example of what I'm talking about, if you don't mind. So let's look at this idea of believing in a God that protects us. Because I believe in God, too, but my idea of God is different than the traditional mainstream idea. So if someone believes in a God that protects them, my question would be, protects us from what? And do you have an answer to that question? What does God protect us from?
Maybe he protects us from committing suicide. Maybe he protects us from hurting other people.
But he doesn't protect us from that because we do commit suicide and we do hurt other people.
No, I mean people who trust and have faith in him. Because if you believe that he is going to protect you, then okay. If something does happen that is very that is horrendous, it's just the most heinous crime that could ever happen, and you mm-hmm. may have witnessed it. Maybe you witnessed your child being ran over by a car.
Mm-hmm.
He may be protecting you from hurting someone else, the person that ran over your child. Maybe a person who doesn't have that strong of a faith in him may want to take revenge and take matters in their own hand. Or they're so distraught that they want to go and jump in a river, or they want to go hang themselves. So instead of doing that, like the book of Job, the book in the Bible, when things were taken from him, he continued to believe and have faith in God. And so mm-hmm. therefore, he did not turn his back, and he continued to have faith. So when things happen in your life that is taken from you, things that are just so unbearable, God is going to protect you from doing something that is hurtful, that's going to make things even worse. That's the protection that I'm speaking on.
Okay, it's an interesting way to look at it, but the way a lot of people believe, like the woman I mentioned before, is that God is also supposed to protect us from danger and loss and pain. And what we find as we go through life is that we cannot be protected from that. So what you're saying is makes a lot of sense, that there is a certain innate moral compass that stops us from going out and murdering the person who ran over our kid. And, you know, we can call that moral compass God. We can call it whatever we want. But in terms of reality, no matter how pious we are or what we believe, tragedy will still occur. There will still be an earthquake. There will still be a tsunami. There will still be a Holocaust. And so when we look at that, this is when we're sort of forced to see everything as being on the continuum and on the wheel, and that we're a part of everything. It doesn't matter what God somebody believes in. We're all going to have the same experiences. So what that causes us to do is to hopefully question and rethink how we understand the universe. This is what, you know, a crisis of faith is really about. And what I tell a lot of people who think that they're angry at God is, well, maybe we need to examine what you think God is. Have you seen the movie that just came out called Heaven Is For Real about the little boy who had the near-death experience? Has anybody seen it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Well, they actually sent me a link before it came out because they wanted me to endorse it, which I did. And what was so great about that movie is that kid came from a family where the father was a Calvinist minister, and they were very traditional and very fundamentalist. And here was this preacher, this father, who preached about heaven and the afterlife and hell and all of that. And when the kid comes up and says, well, yeah, I saw Jesus, but I also saw my little sister who died when she was little, and I saw Grandpa, and I saw all these things. His father, the preacher, had to realize that all the stuff he'd been preaching all this time, he didn't really believe, because he didn't believe his kid when the kid told him that. So he had to stop and reassemble, like the pieces on the kaleidoscope. When something happens, a tragedy, all the pieces break apart and reassemble in a different form. And that's what's supposed to happen to our awareness. We're supposed to evolve in our thinking. We're not here to just stay stuck in one spot and not be, you know, and be stagnant, which is why tragic events happen, to cause us to shift our positions. So that's my radical take on it.
Very interesting. Ma'am, can I put you just on mute, and then now I understand you weren't calling in to ask a question. You're calling to hear the show, and some people can't get it through the computer, so I understand that. So I will put you back on mute, and thank you so much for listening and participating. That was very interesting, and I know you didn't intend to be an object lesson, but
no.
I think it was very helpful.
It happened exactly as it should.
Okay,
exactly.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, well, that was very interesting. I guess if you want, we were kind of in the middle of going through your various roles, and I think we certainly covered one of them very well. Do you want to talk about any of the other kind of functions that you perform, or do you want to just go right in and start talking about the conference itself?
Oh, I can talk about anything. So one of my other roles, and this is, you know, one of the things that my son, I feel, led me to, is I went back to school to get a degree in theology, and I became a chaplain. And I work in hospice, and I work in hospitals on a volunteer basis. And I learned through this an entirely different way of working with sick and dying and bereaved people. And this is what we call meeting them where they are. I get asked this a lot. So knowing what I know about the afterlife, that's all fine and good. But when I'm sitting with a patient who's dying, the last thing I would ever do is try to convince them to believe what I believe. And it's a challenge because most people have never thought about dying. They aren't interested in learning about it. And they come from that same 5-year-old Sunday school version of heaven and hell and have never taken the time in their life to look any deeper than that. So when it comes to the end of their life, they're not prepared and they're completely lost and confused and terrified. And when I come in, they may ask some probing theological questions, and I can certainly have a discussion with them about that. But my role in that capacity as a clinical chaplain is to just be with them wherever they are. And I have been at the bedside of dying people from every imaginable religion and have learned how to go where they go. And, you know, I will pray with a Lutheran or a Protestant or an evangelical or a Buddhist or atheist or, you know, anything they want to be to create some peace for them. One thing, you know, that we do at End of Life is we don't try to change anybody's mind, unless they want to, unless they ask. But usually they don't.
No, I would think that's very interesting. I would think that that would be perhaps the time when people are most set in their ways and most comfortable, most settled into their deepest beliefs, which typically, although certainly not always, are our earliest beliefs.
Exactly. And we are attached to our earliest beliefs because our culture and our educational system doesn't really give us a chance to question them. We're pretty steeped in it, you know, and we pretty much stay there. And you're right, and I'm really glad that you said that, because a lot of people have the misconception that when someone's on their deathbed, you know, everything opens up and they move into forgiveness and love and peacefulness, and they see the error of their ways, and it almost never happens that way. We die the way we live. So if you were a grumpy old man when you were 50, you're going to be a grumpy old man when you're 75 and on your deathbed. And we don't want to change you. We want to just comfort you and bring you peace. Now, every once in a while, somebody will really ponder some deeper questions and want to have a conversation about where they go when they die. And they'll say something like, I've always believed, you know, I've always been taught that there's heaven and hell, but now that I think about it, it just doesn't really make sense. You know, I mean, I'm not a perfect person. I wasn't a child molester or an axe murderer, but, you know, am I going to go to hell? When I really think about it, I have to suddenly realize that that's probably not real. And I'll give you another example. A few years ago, I co-facilitated a grief group for middle school kids. And these kids were 12-ish, and mostly it was their parents who had died. Some of these parents had died by murder or suicide or drug overdoses, pretty intense stuff. And the kids were sitting there one day doing an art project and talking to each other, and this is what I heard them say. One boy said to another, well, my father drank a lot, and he never went to church or anything, so I guess he's going to hell. And the other kid says, but I thought God forgives everybody, so I guess he's going to heaven. And then another kid says, well, how much room is there in heaven? I mean, you know, the sky is only so big. How many people can fit up in the sky? And that was the conversation that I overheard. And I realized that these 12-year-olds, they were all boys, not only had to deal with the grief of losing their parents, but were, you know, forced to ponder these deep theological questions that could have only made their grief more complicated. And it's very sad, you know. They have this notion that your soul flies up to the sky and lives playing a harp on a cloud. And I think that really interrupts the healthy processing of grief.
I was about that age, I guess I was 11, when my grandfather died. And I was very close to him, and it was a awful experience, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And it was very painful and powerful, and it seemed like it lasted forever. You know, it didn't, but part of it, I suppose, is showing the perspective of an 11-year-old. I mean, I probably felt pretty sad, you know, quite actively sad on and off for probably a full year, but now that doesn't sound like that long, you know. But anyway, it was hard. It was very hard. And I had to keep running through the things that, in theory, made it okay and made it so that I could process it and that this was not a punishment. That this wasn't something being done to me or to my mother, since this was her father, nor to my grandfather, nor my his wife, my grandmother, and that it really was very difficult, and it felt kind of overwhelming. 6 years later, I guess, when I was 17, then my grandmother, his wife, died, and that just, again, 6 years doesn't sound like very long, but I might as well have been a different person at 17 from 11. But what happened then, and people who listen to the show fairly often have heard the story more than once, because it really was a watershed moment, I guess, in my life, is I was away at college. I was a freshman at college, and I was in my dorm room. I was sound asleep. It was the middle of the night. I was in Ohio. My grandmother was in California. We had moved to Ohio a few years before from California. And my mother was at her house, at our house, a couple hundred miles away from where I was at school. And as I found out the next morning, the exact same thing had happened to my mother at the exact same time. In the middle of the night, I just sat up, bolt upright, dead awake, no idea why. It was instant, startling, and shocking. The room was black, or almost. There was a dark mass on the other side of the room that moved toward me. It was darker than the blackness. It was a more pitch black. And it moved across the room and enveloped me like an amoeba. And while I was inside of this thing, I was completely powerless. I couldn't move. I couldn't talk. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't do anything. And I understand that scientifically that's a pretty darn perfect description of sleep paralysis. But I know that I was awake. Absolutely. And as I said, it turned out it happened to my mother at the exact same time.
Wow.
So as it turned out, that was when my grandmother died in California. Uh-huh. And we both had the same feelings. And she had a heart attack. So when we were discussing all this, and even when we rushed out to California, and we were talking to the various people involved and whatnot, and I think it was our minister, you mentioned Lutheran, our Lutheran minister out there, who said, well, perhaps you were both sharing the experience with her and taking some of that burden away from her. So I found that very comforting. And, of course, just that whole notion that we were all that connected, my mother and my grandmother and I, and that we had that, you know, inexplicable, at least in scientific terms, connection and that relationship, while it was horrible and terrible and extremely sad, and I was very, very close to her as well, and it was a shock, and she had been planning to move out with us, to come live with us, and we were very excited about that and happy about that. And, you know, so all of that was going on. But the fact that we had that experience and that connection really did kind of mitigate some of the just most abject pain and sorrow that I had felt when my grandfather died. And, of course, the age difference, I'm sure, was a factor as well. But I know that deep down inside, my little kid self really wasn't that different at 17. I thought I was, but I wasn't really, from the deep down little kid inside at 11. And that experience really kind of was the difference. And I felt, I didn't ever after that have a literal experience of speaking directly or communicating like it sounds like you have done many, many times with your son. But I did feel a connection, a post-life connection with her. And I felt whenever I thought, kind of took the time and I suppose it was a form of meditation, I suppose, on some level, to just kind of stop, clear my mind, and think specifically and directly about her, I did feel connected, and I did feel a very strong sense of peace and love, and it made it so much easier. And I have had, I mean, this was, I'm 55, so that happened a long time ago, and to this day, I still feel that I can connect with really both of those, because I kind of started doing it with my grandfather too once I realized or felt that I could with my grandmother. And that's something that's been kind of a touchstone in times of trouble or fear or sorrow for the rest of my life, I mean, until now. And so that's my story.
Well, you've touched on so many important things, and what you're describing that you had there with your mother is what is now called a shared death experience, and that's the work that Raymond Moody is doing right now. His new book is called Glimpses of Eternity. He's going to be at our conference, and he talks about the shared death experience. And we also have William Peters coming to the conference, who's doing a research project at the University of California at Santa Barbara called Shared Crossings. And it's about exactly what you're talking about. And that connectedness that you felt with your grandmother and your mother is exactly what I'm talking about, with this everybody being on the kaleidoscope together. When we back away from the ego view of this is my body, I live in Portland, my name is Terry, I'm a female, I'm 61, you know, all these identities. When we drop all that, we become just the essence. And at that level, there are no separate identities. There's no mother, grandmother, son. It's all this one essence broken off into little parts temporarily as a mother, a son, a female, a male, having these experiences that are all brought back into the collective soup for the purpose of furthering the collective consciousness. So that makes sense that we can share death experiences, because at that level, when you had that vision and your mother had that vision, you weren't identified with the body for that moment. Maybe you were asleep, maybe you were awake, but just in that moment, the both of you had disconnected from the body just maybe for a second, long enough to be in that open conduit between the dimensions, in that open door. And that's why you were able to see your grandmother. I mean, this happens to everybody, but people don't know what it is. People are afraid of it. You weren't afraid when that happened, right? Were you scared?
I don't exactly know what, I mean, I had a sense of it wasn't till after it was over that I really felt a strong sense of peace and relief. While it was going on, I felt kind of, I definitely had a fear of that feeling of paralysis. I mean, I literally couldn't move, and that frightened me. And I felt that I'm not positive anymore, again, because it was so long ago, if I was breathing or not. I mean, I know I couldn't move, I couldn't talk. I don't know if I was actually
breathing. Well, you were in and
out.
You know, you were in both worlds, and you weren't really in your body enough to move it. I mean, I have very intense dreams, and I experience that paralysis a lot because you're not fully in your body. You know, a lot of belief systems say when we dream, we leave the body. The Buddhists say we're attached by the silver cord. So the paralysis is because the soul's not fully present to move the body, which is what happens when people are in comas or brain death. You know, the soul is not present, so the body isn't fully functioning. But, of course, you came back into the body. And, you know, those shared death experiences, working with the dying in hospice, many times I have had a similar experience to that, not seeing a visual image of a soul. But sometimes when I'm with a dying person, I can synchronize my breathing with theirs. And in doing that, because synchronizing the breathing really creates a powerful connection, I can see what they're seeing, or not so much see it visually, but feel it, feel what they're feeling. It's the most peaceful space I have ever experienced, doing that with a dying person. Because we are meant to have our connection to the higher realms intact. You know, when we come to Earth, it's not cut off. It's still there. And through meditation, through various kinds of psychic processes, we can tap into that connection because it's always open. And I've heard it described as it's like a television that's turned off. So when your TV is off, the signals coming through the cable or the broadcast waves or whatever they are still coming through, right? They're not turned off. They're still being emitted everywhere.
Still being sent
you just
out.
Have your TV off. Right? So that's
exactly
what our body is. It's a receiver like a TV. And we can turn it on. And like, wow, look at all those signals bouncing around. I didn't know those were there. They're always there. And so that's what we're doing, is opening up to receive them. And there are processes and techniques that make that doable, which is one of the things we teach at the Afterlife Conference.
Very interesting. What a brilliant segue. Let us now talk about the Afterlife Conference. My friend.
That was a good segue.
It was.
Okay.
It was. You're like a showbiz legend with that segue.
Oh, I've been doing this all day today. Okay, so the Afterlife Conference. I started this 4 years ago. It's a long story how it got started, but basically it was when my first book, A Swan in Heaven, came out. And because I had experienced the death of a child, I figured that my audience for my book and my workshops would be bereaved parents. And I approached the big national organization support group for bereaved parents and wanted to speak at their conference and was amazed to get the response that they do not allow this kind of discussion at any of their conferences. We don't talk about mediumship. We don't talk about the afterlife. We don't talk about anything spiritual because while it may be comforting to some people, it is disturbing to other people. And that was their policy. And they get about 1,500 people at their conference every year, which means that they're excluding about half of them from real tools and real help for their grief. So I was amazed to hear this. And I did a little research and found out that many of the other authors and teachers who talk about after-death communication were also banned from speaking to this organization for bereaved parents. So I reached out and contacted those people, those authors and those teachers, and I said, we need to start our own conference. We need to create a space where we can talk about this stuff for people who are grieving and offer these tools such as mediumship and awareness of after-death communication and shared death experiences and near-death experiences. So I put this little group of people together and we started the first conference. That's what triggered it. And it just kind of grew up and blew up from there. Now we're in our fourth year, and yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it certainly has. I mean, it's a really impressive roster of speakers, and it's a very broad range that you're covering. Let us definitely, there's a link right there if you're listening to the show on the show page, or if you're listening on the new and now fully functional, very excited to say, America's Most Haunted website. You can listen to the show from there as well. Anyway, there's a link to the Afterlife Conference. So let's tell people, though, who don't have access for whatever reason, it's afterlifeconference.com. That simple. All kinds of information there. And can people still sign up to attend?
Oh, yeah. The conference is June 5th. And we still have plenty of tickets. And go to afterlifeconference.com and you'll find all the information. And I am just blown away that I can get these speakers. You know, they all, and Eben Alexander, he's probably our most famous guy right now because he wrote this book, Proof of Heaven. He's the neurosurgeon who was in a coma and had an out-of-body experience, and book's been on the bestseller list for months, and he's been on Oprah a million times. And this is his second year coming back with us, which is wonderful. And Raymond Moody, who anybody who's ever looked into near-death experience knows who he is, he's the guy who actually coined the term near-death experience. So this is his third year with us, and they just keep coming back because they love this. We have a lot of fun. We have probably about 30% of the people who come are there because they're working through grief and they want some new tools for looking at grief a different way. Probably another 30% are there because they're interested in scientific evidence. You know, they want to see, can we prove how mediumship works? Can we prove that near-death experience is real? So we have a little section for science, and we bring in the scientific researchers like William Peters and Gary Schwartz, who's done work with mediumship. And then the rest of them are just spiritual seekers who are interested in the soul and know that there's more to it than just this physical body and this temporary identity and want to know more about that. And we have a great time. I mean, a lot of, you know, people sometimes they cry, you know, their grief is triggered through a lot of the processes that we do, and we touch on that. The mediums bring in messages from our dead people, and it is very emotional, but the level of joy is amazing. The meeting planner at the hotel we were in last year said to me, "You guys are the happiest conference I've ever seen at this hotel, and you're talking about death. How does that make any sense?" And it's because we have a very accepting and joyous view of death. Why not?
Right. I'm thinking, I'm pondering, I don't know if I want to be joyous about death. Isn't it more, aren't we joyous that we can transcend death? Explain to me your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, yeah, of course we're not joyous about grief. We're not joyous about loss. But the process of death is certainly joyous. Why be any less joyous than when a baby is born? Because it's really exactly the same thing. Remember that it's a revolving door. And when a baby is born,
it's the circle of life.
It's the circle of life, exactly. Back to that circle kaleidoscope thing. You know,
and the colors of the wind.
Right, all of that. And Hakuna Matata.
I'm Disneyfying. Sorry, go ahead. I have
actually,
to
the colors of
one.
The wind was from Pocahontas, I think. It was a different
yes,
movie.
It was. It was. But they're both Disney.
Yes, they are. And, you know, I mean, that the circle of life is really true. Every religion has talked about the circle of life. But when you can, again, step back from that ego identification of this personality, my name, my job, my house, my dog, my husband, my children is who I am. When we can let go of that and realize that we're much more than just that little package, death is just like walking into another room. And our beloveds, our dead people, are just in the next room. They're still here. They're just vibrating on another frequency. But in a culture where we are taught not to believe in other frequencies, it is difficult for many people to find comfort in that or to accept it. Because in Western civilization, we think the physical frequency is the only one there is. This is me. I'm a physical body. When this is done, I'm gone. That's the prevailing belief.
In your experience, who, and by who I mean obviously generalization and stereotyping, I suppose, and groups, but who has the hardest time with grief? In other words, you know, atheists, Catholics, Buddhists, Jains,
Well, I love that question. That is a wonderful question. And in my experience, and this is not scientific, but this is what I've seen, is the people who have the hardest time with grief are atheists. And I don't mean people who don't believe in God in the sky. I mean people who don't believe in any form of non-physical reality.
Right.
So the people who struggle the most with facing death and grief are the ones who think that when the physical body's gone, the lights go out, blackout, flatline, that's it.
Obliteration,
total annihilation. I mean, you can see how painful that would be.
So let's say
somebody dies when they're 45, and you believe that person's going into total annihilation. Their life had no purpose. What was the point of coming from nothingness, living for 45 years, and going back to nothingness? What was the point? And that is bereft. That is emotionally and spiritually bereft.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, when you look at it that way, right? So when you talk to someone
like that. It's a black hole.
Yeah. And so, of course, we can believe anything we want to believe. And I choose to believe that that's not how it is. Because everything in the universe has more purpose than that. You just don't come in and live for 45 years and disappear. What did you do? You left a mark in the world. You invented some software. You had a couple of kids. But that's all going to disappear into oblivion, too. So what's the point? And that is very painful, you know. And in traditional grief counseling, you know, one of the primary things grief counselors are trained to do is to help people find meaning in the loss.
Right.
What was the purpose of this person's life? What am I going to learn from this experience of being a caregiver to my mother while she died of cancer, you know, and spending, you know, 7 months by her side, and then she died, and then I had to, you know, sell all her stuff and move to another city and whatever. Your life changes. Life goes on. You transform as a result of this experience, and that's what's supposed to happen. It isn't just about that one person who died at 45. It's about all the people in his soul family who are affected by his death, because he does not exist in a vacuum. He is not a separate piece of glass in the kaleidoscope. None of those little pieces of glass in a kaleidoscope are separate. So his death and his life provides sponsorship for all the other pieces. Because we're not separate. And it's a whole other way of looking at it.
Very interesting. I would have guessed that, although I'm sure there are some atheists, and we're using that term to mean those who deny any existence beyond the physical, the neurological, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I would think there would be some who actually looked forward to that level of oblivion, although I personally can't imagine that.
Well, maybe so. I mean, maybe if you're in terrible pain and you're suffering for years and years with pain and illness, oblivion would certainly be a relief. You know, I don't know. Ask an atheist. You know, there's a wonderful book called The Atheist Afterlife, and I recommend this to people a lot, because part of the reason a lot of people call themselves atheists is because they reject organized religion. In that sense, I'm an atheist too, because I don't believe in that God either. So the sad part about that is, in rejecting the religion of your childhood and the Sunday school beliefs and the organization and the politics, people tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater and have nothing spiritual. And that is very bereft. So book, The Atheist Afterlife, David Staum is his name. He said, you know, you can still believe in an afterlife without believing in God in the sky. And it's really physics, and there's this theory of physics called the theory of conservation of energy, I think it's called.
Sure,
and
yep.
Yeah, and he uses this analogy. You're riding in a car, you're driving a car really fast, and you spin out of control and you go off a cliff. And the car flies over the cliff and crashes to the ground below and burns. And, of course, you die. And everything that the car is...
Incidentally.
And so everything that the car is turns into something else. The fire and smoke, it turns into heat and fire and smoke, and that goes into the atmosphere. Then the car turns into carbon and burnt stuff and eventually rust and whatever a car turns into, and that goes into the earth and into the atmosphere. And you, in that car, when it hits that ground and you're launched out of your body into space, you keep going somewhere too. I mean, isn't that what, I'm not really up to speed on the physics of it, but energy continues to go until it hits something that diverts it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, sure, inertia, yes, of course.
Inertia, right. We have that. We are that.
I think that makes really good sense, too.
And there's no religion in that idea at all. It's just physical science.
I mean, of course, science is a belief system as well, though
yes.
it is a belief system that purports to be based on objective and, most importantly, repeatable.
Mm-hmm.
That's the essence of science, is that it's repeatable. And that's where we have this disconnect between even the scientific, as in experimental and whatnot, research into ESP and into, the workings. We're at a point in time, I think it's very, very exciting, where it's hard to distinguish between aspects of neuroscience and aspects of physics and the spiritual realm. It's hard to know exactly where that line is drawn. And I think there's a lot of shows. TV has been real good for the last several years in that regard. I like the Morgan Freeman show. Now, he is absolutely a purported atheist, but when he presents these concepts, he seems to be quite open-minded, certainly, to the possibility or even probability that there's more out there than we know. I mean, that's certainly not an unscientific outlook. I mean, who thinks we know all there is to know? I mean, I hope there isn't anyone out there who really thinks we know there's all there is to know, and as
well,
has been said many times.
Just
to finish that thought, and then I
so
absolutely
iffy.
Want to.
Sorry,
go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, that's
why
the term atheist is so weird, because atheist means non-theist, not believing in a thee,
right.
In theology. And so Morgan Freeman believes in consciousness. He believes that there's more than the physical body, obviously, when you look at that show. And he's had on that show Stuart Hameroff, who is a anesthesiologist in Arizona, who was at our conference in 2012,
right.
who looks at levels of consciousness. In medicine, they measure levels of awareness where, say, zero is neutral, like you and I are at zero right now. And then when we go under anesthesia, we go down to minus 10 or something like that. And Stuart has measured it to, like, plus 50 or something, So these guys who call themselves atheists are still aware of consciousness. And so I would just love to get rid of that word atheist and just call it, empiricist or some other word, because what they're rejecting is religion, and I totally support that. But they're not rejecting consciousness and non-local reality.
And many are not rejecting spirituality either. You know, they're, I don't think it's difficult to separate yourself from organized religion, which certainly has a spotty past, shall we say.
Yes.
And, you know, certainly from a structural standpoint. And you know, on the other hand, how could it not? Because it's run by people. And we know that people are quite imperfect, even those who would, you know, like people to think they are perfect. So, anyway, I have no problem with people who have problems with organized religion, but who do not reject the notion of spirituality, and people who feel connected to something larger. I had one more question. That was a really quick hour. Really enjoyed it. Lots of stuff I got to think about here. You're really interesting. I wish I'd love to be able to go to the conference, but we're just kind of run out of time. I mean, for my
You're
planning.
Really interesting to talk to, too, Eric. Thank you. I'm really having a good time talking with you as well.
I appreciate that, and I'm very, very glad to hear that. what I wanted to ask you, as part of your sort of structure, your worldview, does that include reincarnation?
Absolutely. As far as I can tell, nothing else makes sense. And that's a whole other conversation, but
that's a big topic.
That's a big topic, but yes, absolutely. And again, you know, we have evidence of this that is indisputable. It's, you know, the kinds of stories that we've heard people tell and the research that's been done. Have you seen that new TV show about past life regressions? I don't have TV, but I've seen it online.
Which one?
I don't know. It's a guy who does past life regressions with people. And then he researches the history and finds, you know, the stuff that they remembered was actually recorded in history. And that's on mainstream TV on, I don't know what channel, but because I don't watch TV, but I've seen it online. But, you know, so, you know, we're beginning to prove this stuff. And yes, I do believe in reincarnation, and I can go way into a lot of detail talking about that. But if these souls are eternal, it would make sense that they would choose to incarnate again and again for lack of a better phrase, for the thrill of experiencing. And this goes back to the creation of everything. And if you've ever heard Esther Hicks channeling Abraham, what he says is, in the beginning, there was a stream of energy. Just think of it as a blur, like white noise. And in this white noise, there is every possibility of creation. And somewhere in this white noise, some aspect of it has this thought that says, I think I'd like to see this white noise from a different perspective, other than being right in the middle of it. And so this crazy mad thought pops out of the stream of the white noise and sees it from outside looking in. Just because, I don't know, just because it wanted a different perspective. And in that happening is how physical matter was created.
Fascinating. And it does make a lot of sense. It's actually quite logical.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that. Not exactly that. I think I like yours a little better even, but I've heard that kind of basic concept of manifestation and experience. I've even heard it from the perspective of that God did that. God wanted to have all of these different individual experiences and to actually feel them and live them. And that certainly makes sense through Jesus as well, of course. You know,
right.
If you're going to take it all the way, right? If you're going to if you're going to follow it to its final conclusion, then you will have to be made flesh and all of that that entails, including that what we just went through, you know, just in the last several days, that the horrible experience of ridicule, torture, and death, and then transcendence. So, yeah, amazing stuff. All the best luck with the conference, and I will continue to follow your progress. Love to talk to you again down the line and see what's new and what's going on. Love to hear how this particular conference goes down the line. But, again, we want to refer everyone to it. It's the Afterlife Conference. It's in Portland, June 5th through 8th. And all information is available through the afterlifeconference.com website. Thank you so much, Terry. Really enjoyed it. Appreciate your having the stamina to talk to the to do your fourth
you
interview
so
of the day and to do to throw yourself into it to the extent that you did. I really appreciate that.
I appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you so much, Eric.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Hope to talk to you soon. Have a great week. Have a great conference.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Good night, everyone. Have
Good
a great
night.
Week. We'll be back next Tuesday, as always, at 10 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday night, and going in an entirely different direction. I'm really excited about this. We will be talking about the show Bates Motel with people closely associated with that show. So that will be all kinds of fun. We'll talk to you then. In the meantime, check us out on America's Most Haunted website. It's americas-most-haunted.com, at AM Haunted on Twitter, at AM Haunted on Facebook. I'm Eric Olson. Have a great night. Farewell.